Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, with speculation about the IMF needing to intervene for France, we ask if Europe is potentially in the throes of a debt crisis. And back at home, with all of the talk about foreign direct investment, we turn our attention to Indigenous businesses and ask what the government needs to do to promote homegrown enterprise when we talk to three of Ireland's busiest entrepreneurs. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, I want to start off today by explaining to you what a bond investor is, but more importantly, whether you might be one of them. During the week, we saw that bond investors pushed the yield in the US up to 5%. And I'm going to be bringing up bond investing a little bit today, so I wanted to talk to you about it first. So bond investors are people who buy government bonds, or in other words, they lend money to the government in exchange for an interest rate. Now, if you have money in the post office or in prize bonds in Ireland, you're a bond investor because you've lent money to the government. If you have money in a pension that buys Irish or any other country's bonds, you're a bond investor. In fact, if you've invested in anything that lends money to companies or governments, you're a bond investor. Therefore, if you hear anything in the coming weeks about the US or the French or the Italian or the Irish bond market, it could be you. France is facing a growing debt challenge, with public debt now exceeding 115% of GDP and borrowing costs on the rise. With political uncertainty adding to the mix, investors are watching closely, and the implications extend far beyond Paris, potentially affecting the broader Eurozone. Now, today we're joined by Sarah Collins, Brussels correspondent with the Business Post, to break down what's happening, why it matters, and what it could mean for France and Europe's financial stability. Now, Sarah, it's a big day in France on Monday the 8th of September. France's deficit is hitting 5.8% of GDP. François Bayrou, the fourth prime minister in 2 years, wants to cut 44 billion from the budget and two public holidays. There's a vote of confidence in this, which he called himself, and it seems unlikely that it's going to be voted through. So how did France get to this point?
Oh, it's a good question. France hasn't really been stable for the last 2 years. I mean, there have been, especially in the last year, last summer, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, called a snap election after the European election, sort of put him in a little bit of a weird position. He thought it would bolster him. It didn't. Here we are a year later, two prime ministers in, and another one is set to bite the dust. It really doesn't look like Bayrou can survive. I've spoken to a couple of sort of French insidery politicians, and they basically say he's cooked, you know. The question is, what happens next? How do they get the budget through? Because there's an end of year deadline for budget 2026 to get approved. And if they don't get it through, what does that mean for France's, for example, pledge to increase defense spending, to put boots on the ground in Ukraine, possibly, you know, to contribute to European defense, which is one of the major priorities, and why they need to make some cuts in the budget so they can afford the things that they do want.
But Bayrou has been saying, listen, if we don't get this through, well, then I'm going to have to call the IMF. I mean, is that an empty threat?
I think was that the French finance minister, Eric Lombard, heard him making that threat as well, like a few weeks ago. It does feel like a little bit of an exaggeration. You know, France, it may have a large budget deficit, but there's certainly not a solvency issue here. I think what he's trying to do is to maybe focus people's minds and get them to sort of come together in some sort of spirit of solidarity. Whether that will work is really unclear. I mean, there are these like sort of three distinct blocks in the French National Assembly and the Parliament. You know, you have the centrists. François Bayrou is the prime minister of a kind of centrist block. You have the far left and the far right. And even within the far left, for example, the left itself, there's splits between the socialists and, you know, Jean-Luc Mélenchon's La France Insoumise, the kind of far left, about where to go, how much to cut from the budget, and who should lead this new parliament once Bayrou falls, which everybody expects him to. So it is all a bit of a mess. Whether the IMF would need to be called at this stage, no, I don't think so.
Can we just look then at the composition of the parliament and what they want? Because the socialists and Marine Le Pen's Rassemblement National wants to lower the retirement age back from 64, to which Macron raised it, to 62 or even 60. And this is at the same time the government is spending a quarter of its budget propping up the existing pension situation in France. And even the Socialist Party is putting forward a more modest fiscal package worth 22 billion and based largely on a 2% annual wealth tax on individuals worth more than 100 million. So as I listen to you, Sarah, if I was a French voter, what exactly is the reality here about what is feasible to happen? If this doesn't go ahead on Monday, which, as you say, it's probably not going to, what then?
Yeah, it's really unclear. And I think that's what's so destabilizing at the moment, and maybe why markets are having a tiny bit of a wobble and have sort of are asking more from French government bonds, you know, more to borrow. The cost of paying interest has gone up. So look, here we have 44 billion suggested by Bayrou in cuts and tax rises. The socialists are talking, you know, their kind of main plank is this new wealth tax. Mm-hmm. They call it the Zuckman tax. It's named after this French economist. Anybody with wealth, personal wealth of over 100 million should be taxed. They believe they can raise tens of billions, I think they've put on it, meaning they won't need to cut the budget as much. They also hate the Bayrou's plan to axe two public holidays. They absolutely hate it. I don't think there was a time in French politics when they weren't talking about pensions and retirement ages and, you know, labour reforms. It's kind of a trope. This was a reform that was brought in 2 years ago by Emmanuel Macron at the time, the raising of the retirement age, apologies. I don't know if they're going to roll back on that. It's certainly one of the demands. I was reading former chief economist of the IMF, seeing as we talk about the IMF, Olivier Blanchard, he's been tweeting a lot lately about this. And he's like, look, the reality of this is you're going to have to make cuts. You can probably talk around the edges of the cuts, but they're going to have to be big. I think he likened it to the chemotherapy. The medicine is tough. You got to take it. But tweaking little bits of reforms here and there are not going to do it. And he doesn't believe the wealth tax will raise enough money, as much money as the socialists are saying it will. So he said, yeah, cut, cut, cut. I mean, he probably would. He worked in the IMF. They're kind of hawks in that sense, but that's his take.
But that loops us back then to what actually is on the table, which is currently potentially not going to be voted through. Is that sensible sort of thinking? But I would like to shift the conversation a little bit to the Eurozone, please. So if the socialist was to move forward on this, they say it would take 3 more years to meet their own requirements of the EU's deficit limit of 3% as part of the Stability and Growth Pact. How would that go down in Brussels?
Look, when France comes to Brussels with a budget plan, they are usually pretty open to listen. And if it's a case of your government is going to keep falling and you can't have any political stability if this budget, you know, if you don't make changes to the budget, I think they listen. The EU has these budget rules, but they changed them last year. There was this big reform and the whole point of it was to make things more flexible. You know, you're not there to kind of essentially interfere in politics and make it harder for a prime minister to get a budget through. So look, the French already have, I think, 7 years is it to reduce their deficit. They have a certain path, the EU, you know, and France will set the path together that can be adjusted here and there. France has also applied for kind of budget flexibility. So the EU has this new plan to boost defence spending. Under that, they'll allow countries to, you know, not necessarily hit their budget targets exactly if they're using some of the money for defence. So there's tweaks that can be done. That, you know, France is really not at that stage yet. We've still got a few months left to agree the budget. There's still the budget 2026. There's still, you know, if it doesn't get agreed, they can do this thing where they go back to the budget of the previous year. It's messy. It's not ideal, but it's not the end of the world. So we're not at the Brussels stage yet. And everybody really in Brussels is just much more focused on Ukraine at the moment, is more focused on trade with the US and just the wider geopolitical picture. Obviously, French instability, not good. But for the moment, I think it's just playing out in Paris and not Brussels.
It's interesting listening to that. It sounds like this is a French problem that is going to be kicked down the road for a little while. Status quo is to go back to the plan for last year, which, of course, was a higher deficit than was planned. The only reason, of course, that had gone ahead is because there was an abstention of a vote in the parliament. What is it, Sarah, about French politics whereby you can have like four prime ministers in 2 years and like if you look back at the length of time that the prime ministers were in place, not the president now, but the prime ministers were in place, it's much shorter than many other countries around Europe. And yet, that isn't deemed a political crisis per se. It's more, oh, well, here we go again.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, France's political system is such that the president stays in place and Macron is very much, you know, that even if he's not liked by most of the Assemblée Nationale, he's still the kind of continuity there. And he's looking ahead, and many parties in the French Assembly are looking ahead to 2027, mm-hmm. when elections are coming up. Macron himself is also extremely much more focused on foreign affairs. And I think he's tried to, even though there have been lots of calls for his head again this time, he's kind of keeping his hands clean a little bit, keeping out of it, letting the parties, the right and the left, fight the fight. But there is like a huge question mark over what that means for his centrist coalition and whether, you know, he's kind of goosed for the 2027 elections, because however this plays out will have massive implications for him.
It will, of course. And even that decision now, I wonder if I was to talk to him himself and I wasn't on the radio and I asked him, does he regret calling that snap election last year? I wonder what he'd say. Can I stick with the European comparison for a moment? And I'll also go across the Atlantic in this. So France's 10-year borrowing costs have jumped to 3.6%. You've already alluded to that. Bond investors are worried about the ability for France to manage their deficit and naturally enough then to repay the debt. But those levels that I mentioned, that 3.6%, it's a very high level. It's similar now to Greece and Italy, but below the US and the UK. And Sarah, I can't believe I'm saying this. And maybe that's because the memory of 2010 is so etched in my mind, when the idea of a Eurozone country having a bond yield that is higher than the UK, or sorry, lower than the US or the UK is striking. So what or how do bond investors feel about this now, do you think, in a Eurozone context?
Like, they've certainly increased the amount they're asking for the French. I mean, French borrowing costs have gone up, French debt interest has gone up, which also plays into the budget talks, right? If it costs you more to repay your debt, you're going to have to raise more taxes or cut more from mm-hmm. the budget than you had originally planned.
Or borrow more.
So far, there is not a huge, like, there's not a major wobble. Yes, it's true that investors are worried. There was a Deutsche Bank note that was sent around to investors earlier this week, and they said, like, we're more worried about France than we are about Italy. But I think, you know, France is a massive, it's the second largest European and Eurozone economy. It's a different kind of wobble when a big economy, when something happens in a big economy, than when it happens in a small economy that maybe has only one or two kind of sources of revenue, or, you know, where its economy is dependent on one particular sector. France is very different. It's a huge power. I was reading, like, the IMF itself is still like, look, the French, yes, instability, yes, we're not sure about the deficit cutting path, but the labour market is still kind of sound. Inflation is down. France is resilient in that kind of way, that it's not causing, we're nowhere near a Eurozone debt crisis, put it that way. Nobody's panicking and nobody should panic. This is not having any effects on the euro either, like ING analysts mm-hmm. were saying. It's not an issue. And even if it were, we have the European Central Bank as the lender of last resort. It has, you know, a specific instrument created during COVID where if the bond spreads go wild between France and Germany, you know, they can step in. We're nowhere near this point. So something to watch, but let's see what happens on Monday. Let's see what happens in the days and weeks following, and whether that budget, whether the political system can kind of get together and either, you know, agree to disagree and get the budget through, or whether they find a compromise candidate for Prime Minister.
Isn't it so intriguingly different from 2010, when none of those instruments were in place? Like, the ESM is now in place, as you say, the ability for the ECB to step in a different way. It's just intriguing, the difference in how hopefully the lessons have been learned. Of course, yeah. I have to ask the big question, which is, let's jump forward to 2027. If Marine Le Pen from Le Pen's Rassemblement National, sorry, I was just trying to get my pronunciation right there.
You did well.
Thank you. If Marine Le Pen was to win the presidency, do you think that could lead to a debt crisis. Could that be the thing, the political crisis, if you want to call it that, maybe people wouldn't, that could precipitate the debt crisis that happens? Because it's not so long ago when she said she wanted to take France out of the euro.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Marine Le Pen, let's see what happens. She's going through her own travails at the moment. Like, mm-hmm. she has said that she wants, she was convicted of embezzlement earlier this year. She was banned from running for office for 5 years. She's appealing that. So let's see if she can even run for president. It's absolutely unclear. I know her kind of the president of the RN, Jordan Bardella, is kind of, you know, nipping at her heels. Would investors be worried about an RN victory? I think that the RN, in the same way as Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy party did, when you get into government, you soften and you realise that you can't be as, you know, extreme as you always were, and you have bond markets to think about and you have investors to think about and CEOs to think about. So it's also very hard to think 2 years into the future what that mm-hmm. could look like, especially because, like, there's literally things are changing day by day. Let's see what happens on Monday. It'll be really interesting to see the debate after and the political leaders, what they say and who might. I mean, so far, like, when this happened, when Barnier resigned, the former French prime minister, there was a lot of talk about who could succeed him. There isn't at the moment, because Macron does not want to let Bayrou go. Mm-hmm. He wants the other parties to just support him and find a compromise. There's just no, it's unclear to me what and who will emerge as a kind of compromise.
Well, there's certainly going to be a lot of eyes around the world watching this, including mine, Sarah, and we'll catch up again on that. So thank you so much for joining me. This is Sarah Collins, Brussels correspondent with the Business Post. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and it's time to ask you my economics trivia question. So I was in France earlier on this week, and my question is based on these clues. Can you tell me which city I was in? It has the third largest population growth in the country. It is the leading economic area in Western France. And possibly most tellingly, it has a famous elephant. Email me at takingstock@newstalk.com if you know, and I'll tell you at the end of the show. After the break, we look to talk to three of Ireland's biggest entrepreneurs about what business really needs. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Well, along with the continuing refrain that Ireland's foreign direct investment is a golden egg that could stop laying at any time, we also hear that we need to do more for Ireland's indigenous businesses. So does the state do enough for homegrown entrepreneurs who employ thousands of people? So I'm delighted to say that I'm now joined by three of Ireland's most successful entrepreneurs. It's great to welcome Pat McDonough from Supermax, Lorraine Heskin from the Gourmet Food Parlour, and John Purdy from Ergo. So, Lorraine, I'm going to start off with you, and I'd like to get straight to the point on the 9% VAT cut, because there's a lot of people talking about that at the moment. So the Department of Finance has said it would cost 674.6 million for food and catering, and that's over a year. That would be 715 million if it included accommodation, entertainment and hairdressing. And the Irish Hotels Federation Chief Executive Paul Gallagher has said in the lead up to the general election and afterwards, discussions between hospitality representative bodies and the government have always said it's on the basis of any VAT reduction applying to hospitality food services only. Mm-hmm. So, Lorraine, what difference would reducing the VAT to 9% make for your business?
So the reduction of the VAT to 9% would make a huge difference. It would be substantial. If I look at the last 11 out of the last 14 years, the VAT rate has been 9%. So fundamentally, as a business, for that to change, you're taking 4.5% off your bottom line. Notwithstanding the other increases, minimum wage, energy costs, food costs, etc. So ultimately, what we want to do is we cannot put this onto the customer plate. We don't have that. We don't have the value of projects where we can bring in, you know, a baseline profit of, you know, turnover of 2 million, whatever. We demand that customers are coming into our restaurants every day. We need them to come in every day. And that's fundamentally it. But for the survival of our industry, the overheads are far too much. We need the government to come in and help us in terms of even training our staff, training new staff, bringing in energy subsidies, the VAT rate, etc. And even just looking at a national marketing campaign to even try and look at, you know, supporting Irish businesses. I mean, if you look at the amount of businesses that have closed this year, 600 cafes and restaurants, restaurants alone in 2025. They're not all doing something wrong. You know, something has to give. And I feel so strongly about us not continuing to increase the price. We can't. So as a business, we've had to absorb a lot of these additional costs over the last year, 2 years, etc. And fundamentally, if you go back to COVID in 2020, what we've experienced as an industry and businesses in general, and also then you're going through, you went through the cost of, you know, living crisis, which we're still going through. You've had the war that has increased food prices. It's increased coffee prices. It's increased energy. I mean, it's coming at us from every side. And within our industry, our most important person is our customer, and we need to protect them, but we also need to protect our business. And I'll finish with this as well. I mean, I feel very strongly within our business and in our industry that we provide a progressive path for careers within our industry. I don't want someone who wants to work in hospitality to think that they have to stay at the same stage all the time. And in Gourmet Food Parlour, we've provided those paths for career progression. I'm really proud of it, but I want to be able to continue to reinvest in my people and to provide them with that living that they can have every day and be proud to work in our industry.
Okay, Pat, you're in the food business as well as other industries and sectors too, which I'll get on to. But what's your take on the 9% rate?
Well, look, we represent not just ourselves, but about 48 small businesses across the country and franchises. And since energy costs, as been said already, have increased by 80% since 2019. They've gone up by 80%. Food costs have gone up by 30%. Rates, insurance and water rates have consistently been varying from county to county. And, you know, the costs of doing business have tremendously increased. You know, and you also have a kind of a slowing down in the market, because 61% of customers have reduced their amount of times visiting a restaurant since 2019. In other words, 61% less, they go to the restaurant less. And of the 100% that went to the restaurants, say, in 2019, 82% buy less when they go to the restaurants. They might have a two course, or they might have a single course, or they might have a few drinks or whatever. So, like, we have a situation where the disposable income, because of the cost of living, and because of the cost of rental, and because of the cost of everything going up, there's less disposable income out there. So it's a situation where, you know, in fairness, I think the government needs to look at it. Sometimes I think they forget about, you know, the indigenous Irish business, because there's so much talk about foreign direct investment and tariffs, et cetera, et cetera. But as I say, it has to be looked at a lot more closely. And I think it's a necessity, especially in the food business and the drinks business, because 20% less alcohol is consumed in pubs than before 2019 as well.
But and Pat, if I could just ask you, because I'm sure there's people listening today who are saying, well, it's not the government's job to subsidise costs.
It's not, but it's the government's job to make sure that inflation isn't going to a degree and to keep costs at bay. And if you have, the government have kind of delegated to agencies, and whether that's, you know, county councils, or whether it's Irish Water, or whether it's you know, any of the agencies across the board, they have delegated the responsibility to them. And in actual fact, you know, if you look at the ESB, like the ESB, for us to connect to ESB, and in apart from the cost of bringing the connection from A to B, which was a 1.5 million in Innes, which is the latest place we're looking at. Apart from that cost, ESB charged you 173,000 just to connect you. So the costs of doing business are increasing. And not, this is not to mention planning and all the rigmarole.
We'll get to that. We won't have the whole day for it, but we certainly will get to that. John, can I go to you? Because I have read extensively the white paper on enterprise that was published by the department. And there's a quote in there that says the contribution of foreign direct investment to the Irish economy is far-reaching. Okay, I think we'd all agree with that. And it's estimated that 20% of all private sector employment in the state is directly or indirectly attributable to FDI. But John, that means 80% then of private sector employment is down to Indigenous businesses. So what do you think is being done to encourage that in Ireland?
clearly not enough. The tax returns that we saw yesterday, I think, suggest that there's a worrying sign that the dependency on foreign direct investment and the tax it generates is not sustainable. There's a very vibrant ecosystem in Ireland in the indigenous sector, but it's underfunded. And my experience is that entrepreneurs spend way too much time looking for funding and not enough time growing their business and executing on their business plan.
But then, John, like, that sounds in conflict, really, because if we're there to, and like, I'm a business owner for the past 15 years and I've engaged with the agencies and I've applied for funding. It's sometimes been successful and sometimes not. But if I don't do that, well, then I'm not engaging with the policies that are available from the government.
So I think people like Enterprise Ireland do a phenomenal job in this country. But I don't think that's the issue. The issue is that a startup raises money, very quickly runs out of money, needs working capital. The only sources of funds to go back to their existing shareholders. It's dilutive, which is not ideal. Small individual shareholders will only go so much on the risk journey because there is no incentive for them. If it turns out, and what, let's be honest, 2 in 10 hit the highlights and they get a return on their investment, the rest bobble along or don't make it. And there's no incentive for me or Lorraine or Pat to put our hard-earned money into startups and take that risk. And that risk reward needs to be balanced in some way.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the government needs to balance out the risk that people take in order to invest in companies with a view to then supporting employment.
Exactly. And the government's answer will be, say, well, we have EIIS. Personally, I think it's a flawed product. I don't think it has done what it's supposed to do. The government very, very bravely brought out a product a couple of years ago and delivered it through the SBCI, which was backed by the bank, and the bank couldn't look for personal guarantees. But when you went looking for that money, particularly people in the digital economy, which, let's be honest, it's the foundation of our economy, they didn't like it at all. So if I wanted to buy a JCB, I could get $250,000 from them. But if I wanted to invest in digital assets or software development, they just wouldn't listen.
Okay. So I want to certainly delve into more of what you said there. But Lorraine, I'm going to come to you on a point that the ESRI, the Economic and Social Research Institute, has found that smaller Irish enterprises are less prepared for the climate transition. For example, they say 83% of micro firms, of which you're not because your business is much bigger, but 83% of micro firms have no climate plan in place. And I'm wondering here, Lorraine, like, I see this theme about climate and the green transition a lot in policy, but is a focus on sustainability something that you feel is supported by government? Is it a distraction? Is it, look, it's in the future, it's not really brought into today? Or is it a way in which businesses can get a more of a unique selling point?
Well, for sure, if you don't have a sustainability plan in your business plans right now, you're not at the races. You do need to. And I think even within our own industry and from my own perspective, we would have an in-house team who are working on a full sustainability plan, not just reducing carbon footprint, but also looking at ways to, keep our business within Ireland from a packaging perspective, working with closer with local suppliers, etc. I think it's a huge aspect. We don't get any assistance on it whatsoever. So it's all self-motivated and it's all part of what we do as a brand.
So I've gone for the green for business support, for example, that was available by the local enterprise office. It took me about an hour to apply for it. I got 2 days consultancy, then it was fully funded. I was approved for that within 48 hours. Like, isn't that something tangible that can be done then, Lorraine?
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, we were very lucky. We actually got a consultant to work with us at the beginning. That was through business connections. That wasn't through a grant that I or I suppose a system or something that was available to me as a business. I find a lot of the time that the lack of communication around what's available for business, you have to go and find it yourself. Of course you do. It's your business. You got to get out there. You got to stand on your 2 feet, put on your big girl shoes and get out and do it. And that's what you have to do. But there is a lack of availability of support for hospitality specifically. And I say that in that I have applied for many things over the years, Susan, and I've got nothing. Like, I genuinely have got very little. I have to say, over COVID, it was fantastic. We wouldn't have survived if we didn't get the support from the government. But I will go back to my original point, and I feel very, very strongly about this. The customer is our most important person, apart from our team, both aligned, but in for different reasons. We cannot continue to put the price up on our customers' plates. We don't want to do it. We have absorbed costs over the last 2 years. We cannot continue to do so. That's not playing the poor mouth. That is just a harsh reality. And I think there are lots of ways that the government can come in and support businesses by, as I was saying, the national campaigns. The 9% is a given. They promised it. It has to come through. The 4.5% off our bottom line is far too high a percentage to continue to absorb. And it's not that people want, the businesses are just not making the margin now. And we want to look after our team. We want to look after our staff. We want to look after our business, and we want to grow our business because the world is changing. People's eating habits are changing. They're eating earlier. Brunch is still popular, but people aren't going out for dinner. They're drinking less alcohol. The list goes on. And there's adaptations that a business needs to bring into their to their day-to-day workings to make that work.
And if you're just joining us now, we are having a wide-ranging conversation here around the policy to support Indigenous Irish businesses. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. We're going to take a quick break and continue our chat with our three business people. Don't go away. Now you're welcome back to Taking Stock. We're going to continue our conversation here around entrepreneurial policy for Irish businesses. Pat, in a company like yours, like you must have scalable digital systems in place that are replicated right across the business. As you mentioned there earlier, there's 48 respective small businesses within the overall company. So how have you developed that, and did you get any, or did you look for any support?
No, we didn't actually look for it because, to be honest with you, the red tape attached to it is not worth the effort of filling it out. So we don't generally bother. We do our own thing. And we have some very good people in IT in the company, and we have very good consultants as well that help us along the way. But, you know, it's constant improvement. And our team in operations are excellent. And they provide the necessary details of what's needed. And together with the IT, they come up with their own systems, and obviously with consultants as well and suppliers, we work it out.
And Pat, there seems to be a kind of a theme developing, I think, this year that AI, we have to move beyond novelty and into productivity with it. And particularly in the US, there's a sense that there's a lot of money being invested in AI, but little enough return. What do you think?
Listen, I'm probably not the person to talk about AI because I'm not very well, awfully well versed in it. But it is a factor that the marketing people are dealing with and are looking at and seeing what benefits it can give to us. And they are, as I say, utilising it in the smaller ways. But we will be obviously developing that over the coming months and years, mm-hmm. because it is a necessity, as I say, for business everywhere. But, you know, I suppose the general trend is that I'm more so into operations, and when you have 3,500 employees across the country, then you're caught up in a lot of more operational issues and planning issues, etc.
Okay. And so, John, your business has acquired three companies. You've spun out twice. You've raised money along the way. So you've been through the equity journey, and obviously we referred to that just before the break as well. Is it a big advantage that we have here in Ireland, Enterprise Ireland, which is the largest venture capital investor in Europe?
So I would be a massive supporter of Enterprise Ireland. I think you have to understand, first of all, they are spending taxpayers' money, so there's a certain level of rigor that they need to go through to ensure they're spending taxpayers' money correctly. And I would be supportive of that. I think some of their programs are really very forward-thinking. I myself am an alumni of the Leadership for Growth program.
Yep.
I was on the second program in 2007, 2008 in Stanford University. That gave me and the other 29 people on that course an appetite for scale. And I think that's really important, that we have Irish companies that don't sell out too quickly and that they scale to be a large employer. And, you know, beyond, there's less than a dozen that have done that. And that has to be a real focus. And for that to happen, things have to change. It can't be just about dilutive capital. There has to be other working capital mechanisms to allow that company grow.
So would you like to see some of the government stand behind loans, for example, to be a guarantor of loans so that then companies can get that working capital from the bank but risk share with the government?
Absolutely. I go back to the point that I made earlier about SBCI and the JCB. We're in a very evolved, developed economy from a technology perspective. And there's an awful lot more. There's some fantastic technology companies out there that are scrapping from month to month for funding, that are underfunded and will eventually run out of road.
Okay, so speaking of running out of road, Lorraine, I'm going to go back to the white paper that I referenced before the break, and I'm going to read out a quote and I'm going to ask you for your reaction, okay? On page 34 of the white paper, it says, "The government is committed to implementing domestic reforms to increase competition, boost productivity and reduce costs where possible." Do you think it's doing that?
Well, it's committed. So, no, not currently, but I can only speak from my own perspective. And it's critical right now within our industry and people are feeling it. And I talk to people within our industry all the time. And it's emotional. It is emotional because it's real and it's true. And you can't come through, you know, COVID and then everything that has followed us since. And then, you know, at the last hurdle, you're closing down your business. And that means everything to you. So I think the reality is, and Pat alluded to this earlier on, we just need to be listened to. We do. We're not talking for no particular reason. It's because we love our businesses and because we believe in them, because they have huge success potential for the future. Our brands are grass-grown, root, you know, Irish brands that we put so much, our heart and soul into. We want them to survive. We want them to be here into the future and to be proud and to go with the times as well. I mean, I continuously invest in my business. It's not just from interior design to making it lovely and, you know, for the customer to enjoy their experience in. It's about investing in the best systems, the best training systems for our staff. All our training is now online so that we don't have to bring people together. We can make it easier for them to access, to learn and to grow. And, you know, Pat spoke about the different systems that we need to invest in. And in our own industry, it is essential. We're currently looking at our whole CRM system all AI driven. That will be on, you know, TV screens in our kitchens and in our head office to allow us to have the best possible information that we can have. We're so willing to invest in all of that. We just can't do everything and we do need support. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so I'm hearing there, in particular, number one, you want to be listened to, but secondly, in an active way. So commitments are one thing, it needs to turn into practicalities. Pat, I'm going to quote you another paragraph from that white paper. "The planning system is currently being reviewed and overhauled to reduce delays in the provision of energy infrastructure, housing and other essential investments. This includes a review of the Planning and Development Act, including the legal definitions of strategic infrastructure. This will simplify the process by which strategic projects can be applied directly to Onboard Pleanála for planning permission." What's your experience?
Well, if you look at the current situation where we are developing Plaza in Innes, that started off 10 years ago, actually. And initially we were requested for 500,000 to withdraw an objection, which we didn't pay. But at any rate, it was proceeded to Onboard Pleanála, and at the time then it was actually turned down, not necessarily for the reason that we didn't pay the 500,000, but for one or two other reasons, which we rectified and applied again. And it has been going on continuously since. And to our dismay, a serial objector then got involved in it and took it to judicial review actually last November. And at any rate, to our dismay as well, we realised that these serious objectors, when they're objecting on grounds that are relative to water treatment or whatever, get their environment issues, they get their expenses paid by the Department of the Environment. So here you have, on one side, the Department of Enterprise encouraging business. On the other side, you have another department endorsing kind of people who are, as I would say, sometimes objecting for different reasons, and serial objectors are right across the country. So the situation is that we currently have the the building pretty much near completion. There's about another 2 months to go. And out of nowhere, for another judicial review. Now, these people haven't ever objected right up along. It has gone through judicial process already. It's gone through the planning authorities. It's gone through every. It's probably the most, how should I put it, examined application, planning application ever in this country. It's gone on for 10 years. And it says to now we'll go to the courts again. So, as I say, what happens in that situation, unless you have certainty in the planning process, and unless you're pretty sure, you can't be always sure, but unless you're pretty sure you're going to get a good chance of getting planning permission, why should you invest? So if this continues, then people won't invest in business in Ireland going forward. And whether it's in our type of business or whether it's in any other type of business, if they feel that somebody can take a spurious objection and delay the process, then you're going to have a situation where people, business people, won't invest going forward. They'll invest in other countries or they'll move to some other business. So that's really the situation on it.
And so, right, at this point now, we've talked about planning, we've talked about VAT, we've talked about the supports, we've talked about the cost of doing business. I'd like to just talk for a moment, John, also about tax, not just VAT, but if we look around at what entrepreneurs or businesses in Ireland have today, we have the R&D tax credit, where companies can claim a refund of €30 for every €100 spent on a qualifying research and development activity. Obviously, we have the low level of corporation tax, 12.5%. We have the entrepreneur relief of 10% up to €1 million of a business sale. We have a generous pension scheme for both employers and employees. How would you like to see the tax code, like you mentioned EIIS earlier on? By the way, for anybody who's not familiar with that, that is basically tax relief on investing into a company. So to go to my question, how would you like to see the tax code amended to support entrepreneurs?
So just a point of clarification, EIIS is PAYE income. So if you've got an entrepreneur who's been on the road for a long time, who's been lucky enough to have an exit, has paid corporation tax on that exit, they then reinvest that money instead of putting that money at risk again. There's no safeguard around that. There's no relief around that. So I think there's a big opportunity there for government to be able to say to mid to small investors that there is some tax relief for the reinvestment of that money. I think that's a significant point that's been missed. I was at the, this morning, the autumn update from Scale Ireland. And one of the points that was made was that in the US, 2% of the national pension reserve is put into startups. In Ireland, that's 0.2%. So that puts us at a massive disadvantage straight away. And I think, you know, if government are really serious about de-risking the returns that are coming from FDI, then they've got to bet on the indigenous sector, and they've got to take a slightly more mid to longer term view of that.
Okay, I'm going to go to all of you as we finish up this conversation just to highlight what it is you're particularly looking for. We know, Lorraine, you'd like the 9% VAT rate and to be promised, it was promised for the 1st of January, sorry, you'd like to keep it there. Certainly, Pat, it sounds like you would like for planning several things to happen there. John, in your case, what you would like to see is the government standing behind companies to get more access to working capital and broaden out the opportunity for companies to engage with the agencies you mentioned, like Leadership for Growth and so on like that. Lorraine, you also mentioned that you wanted the government to really listen. In your case, also, Pat, you said that you wanted less red tape to be around things. And finally, John, you had also mentioned about tax reform, certainly to reward risk-taking into startups. So if there was, apart from that, if there was one more thing to ask for, assuming all of the Department of Enterprise are listening to us this morning, what would it be? I'll go to you all 30 seconds, each of you. Lorraine.
I think for me, I would like to see some kind of a subsidy from the government towards our businesses in terms of maybe energy grants or training of our staff, or something to do with like even new product development, allowing us to bring new aspects and new revenue streams into our own business as well, as something to allow us to do the research around all of that would really help. In restaurants, it's obvious, of course, you need people to walk in the door, but there's also online, there's takeaway, and there's a lot of research that's required to, you know, to bring something like that into a business and implement it positively.
Okay, and I'll go to Pat. Sorry, we're right up against the clock. Pat, one more thing you'd like?
I'd like to see the PAYE workers tax reduced across the board, because, you know, if you give some of your employees a pay rise, 50% of it can be gone in tax.
If they're at the higher age, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The PAYE worker is carrying a lot of the tax burden of the country, and I would like to see them getting some sort of a break.
Okay. And John, last word.
So I think differentiate between companies who are just growing employment to companies who really want to scale off the island and create real large-scale enterprises, so we can compete with the best in Europe and the best in the US.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for that wide-ranging conversation. To Pat McDonough from Supermax, Lorraine Heskin from the Gourmet Food Parlour, and John Purdy from Argo. Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, to give you the answer to my question regarding which city I was in this week, which has the third largest population growth in France, is the leading economic area in Western France and has a famous elephant, it is Nantes. This show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And it's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to chatting to you again next week.